Side 3, Ilium by Dan Simmons, continuing on page 61. 100 yards out, blocking this channel from the actual river, was a narrow island, overgrown with cycads and horsehair ferns, from which birds and small flying reptiles exploded into flight with a maximum of cries and frenzied flapping. Demon wondered idly if there were butterflies on the isle. On a grassy area above the beach, colorful silken tents, lounge chairs, and long tables of food had been set up. Servitors floated to and fro, sometimes bobbing above the heads of the arriving guests. Walking behind Ada from the carryall, Demon recognized some of the workers on the strange scaffolding. Hannah at the apex, tying on more structural elements, a red bandana tied around her head. The demented man Harmon, shirtless, sweating, showing bizarrely tanned skin, was stoking a contained fire 20 feet below Hannah. Other young people, presumably friends of Hannah's and Ada's, shuttled back and forth up the wooden ramps and ladders, carrying heavy loads of sand and extra branches for construction and round stones. A raging fire burned in the clay core of the structure, and sparks rose into the early evening sky. All of the workers' actions appeared purposeful, even though Demon could see no possible purpose to the tall stack of sticks and troughs and clay and sand and flame. A servitor floated by and offered him a drink. Demon accepted and went off in search of a lounge chair in the shade. "This is the cupola," Hannah explained to the assembled guests later that evening. "We've been working on it for about a week, floating materials down the river in canoes, cutting and bending branches to fit." It was after a fine dinner. Sunlight still illuminated the high hills on the near side of the river, but the valley itself was in the shadows, and both rings were glowing bright in the darkening sky. Sparks leaped and floated toward the rings, and the puff of bellows and roar of furnace were very loud. Demon took another drink, his 8th or 10th of the evening, and lifted a second one for Ada, who shook her head and turned her attention back to Hannah. "We've woven wood into a basket shape and coated the center of the furnace, the well, with refractory clay. We made this by shovel, mixing dry sand, bentonite, and some water. Then we rolled the clay-like goop into balls, wrapped them in wet ferns and leaves to keep them from drying out, and lined the furnace well with the stuff. That's what keeps the whole wooden cupola structure from catching fire." Demon had no idea what the woman was going on about. Why build a big gawky structure of wood and then set a fire at its center if you don't want the thing to burn down? This place was an asylum. "Mostly," continued Hannah, "we've spent the last few days feeding the fire while putting out all the little fires the cupola furnace started. That's why we built this thing near the river." "Wonderful," muttered Demon, and went in search of another drink, while Hannah and her friends, even the insufferable Harmon, droned on using nonsensical terms such as coke bed, wind belt, tuyere, which Hannah was explaining meant some little air entrance on their clay-lined furnace, near which the young woman named Emma kept working the wheezing bellows, and melting zone, and molding sand, and tap hole, and slag hole. It all sounded barbarous and vaguely obscene to Demon. "And now it's time to see if it works," announced Hannah, her voice revealing both exhaustion and exultation. Suddenly the guests had to stand back on the sandy river's edge, Demon retreating to the grassy sward near the tables, as all the young people and that damnable Harmon leaped into a frenzy of action. Sparks flew higher. Hannah ran to the top of the so-called cupola, while Harmon peered into the clay furnace contained flames below and shouted for this and that. Emma worked the bellows until she fell over and was relieved by the thin man named Lois. Demon half listened to Ada breathlessly explaining even more details to huddled friends. He caught phrases like blast pipe and blast gate and chilled slag, even though the flames were raging hotter and higher than ever before, and blast pressure. Demon moved another 15 or 20 feet further back. "Tapping temp of 2300 degrees, Harmon shouted up to Hannah. the thin woman wiped sweat from her brow, made some adjustment to the cupola far above, and nodded. Demon stirred his drink and wondered how long it would be before he could get Ada alone in a carryall on the way back to Ardis Hall. Suddenly there was a commotion that made Demon look up from his drink, sure that he would see the whole structure in flames, Hannah and Harmon burning like straw figures. Not quite. While Hannah was using a blanket to swat out flames on the ladder below the top of the cupola, waving away helpful servitors and even a voynix that had come in close to protect the humans from harm, Harmon and two others had finished poking inside the fiery furnace and had just opened a tap hole, allowing what looked to be yellow lava to flow down wooden troughs to the beach. Some of the guests surged forward, but Hannah's shouts and the radiating heat from the flow of liquid metal forced them back. The crudely carved and lined troughs smoked but did not burst into flame as the yellow-red metal flowed sluggishly from the cupola structure, past the ladders, spilling the last foot or two into a cross-shaped mold set in the sand. Hannah rushed down a ladder and helped Harmon seal off the tap hole. They both peered through a peephole into the furnace, did something to, Ada was explaining to a guest, the slag hole, different from the tap hole, Demon vaguely noticed. And then the young woman and the older man, soon to be a dead older man, Demon thought cruelly, leaped from the cupola structure onto the sand and rushed over to look at the mold. More guests surged down the beach. Demon wandered down, setting his drink on a passing servitor's tray. The air was very cool down here by the river, but the heat from the red glowing mold in the sand struck Demon's face like a fiery fist. The molten stuff was congealing into a red and gray cross-shaped mass. "What is it?" Demon asked loudly. "Some sort of religious symbol?" "No," said Hannah. She took off her bandana and wiped her sweaty, soot-streaked face. She was smiling like a crazy person. "It's the first bronze cast in what, Harmon? 1,000 years? "Probably 3 times that long," the older man said quietly. The guests muttered and applauded. Demon laughed. "What good is it?" he asked. Harmon looked up at him. "Of what good is a newborn baby?" said the sweating, bare-chested man. "Precisely my point," said Demon. "Loud, demanding, smelly. Useless." The others ignored him as Ada gave Hannah, Harmon, and the other workers hugs, just as if they'd actually done something of worth. Guests milled. Harmon and Hannah climbed ladders and started fussing, peering through peepholes and poking into the furnace with metal bars as if there was to be more of this lava production. Evidently, thought Demon, this pyrotechnics show was to continue into the night. Suddenly needing to urinate, Demon wandered up past the tables, considered the tent-covered restroom pavilion, and decided, in the spirit of all this pagan nonsense, to respond to this call of nature al fresco. He climbed above the grassy shelf toward the dark line of trees, following a monarch butterfly that had fluttered past him. There was nothing unusual at seeing a monarch, but it was late in the day and season for it to be out and flying. He walked past the last voynix and moved under the high branches of elms and cycads. Somebody, possibly Ada, shouted something from the river's edge 100 feet away, but Demon had already unbuttoned his trousers and did not want to act the cad. Instead of turning back to respond, he moved another 20 feet or so into the concealing darkness of the forest. This would just take a minute. "Ah," he said, still watching the butterfly's orange wings 10 feet above him as the patter of his urine fell on a dark tree trunk. The huge Allosaurus, 30 feet long from snout to tail, pounded out of the darkness at 20 miles per hour, ducking under branches as it lunged. Demon had time to scream, but chose to tuck himself back into his trousers rather than turn and run while thus exposed. For all his lechery, Demon was a modest man. He raised his heavy wooden walking stick to fight off the beast. The Allosaurus took the cane and arm both, ripping the arm free at the shoulder. Demon screamed again and pirouetted in a fountain of his own blood. The Allosaurus knocked him down and ripped his other arm off, tossing it into the air and catching it like a morsel, and then proceeded to hold Demon's armless but still thrashing torso down with one massive clawed foot, until ready to lower its terrible head again. Casually, almost playfully, the monster bit Demon in half, swallowing his head and upper torso whole. Ribs and spinal column crunched and disappeared into the thing's maw. Then the Allosaurus gobbled the man's legs and lower body, flinging pieces of flesh around like a dog with a rat. The fax buzz started then, even as two Voyniks rushed up and killed the dinosaur. "Oh my God!" cried Ada, stopping at the edge of the trees as the Voyniks finished their bloody rendering. "What a mess," said Harmon. He waved the other guests back. "Didn't you warn him to stay inside the Voyniks' perimeter down here? Didn't you tell him about the dinosaurs?" "He asked about Tyrannosauruses," Ada said, her hand still over her mouth. "I told him there weren't any around here." "Well, that's true enough," said Harmon. Behind them, the crucible continued to roar and shoot sparks into the darkening sky. 9. Ilium and Olympus. "Aphrodite has turned me into a spy, and I know the punishment we mortals have always dealt out to spies. I can only imagine what the gods will do to me. On second thought, I'd rather not. This morning, the day after I became a secret agent for the goddess of love, Athena quantum teleports herself down from Olympus and morphs into a Trojan, the spearman Laodicus. Obeying Zeus's command that the warriors of Ilium should be made to break the current truce, she seeks out the archer Pandarus, son of Lycan. Using the cloaking Hades helmet and private teleportation medallion that my muse gave me, I QT after Athena, then morph into a Trojan captain named Acephalus, and follow the disguised goddess. Why did I choose Acephalus? Why is this minor captain's name familiar to me? I realize then that Acephalus has only hours to live, that if Athena is successful in using Laodicus to break the peace, this Trojan, at least according to Homer, is going to get an Argive spear through his skull. Well, Mr. Acephalus can have his body and identity back before that happens. In Homer's Iliad, this breaking of the truce occurred just after Aphrodite had spirited Paris away from his one-on-one battle with Menelaus. But here, in the reality of this Trojan War, that non-confrontation between Menelaus and Paris had happened years ago. This truce is a more mundane thing, some of King Priam's representatives meeting with some of the Achaeans' heralds, both sides working out some abstruse agreement about time off from the fighting for festivals or funerals or some such. If you ask me, one of the reasons this siege has dragged out for almost a decade is all this time off from the fighting. The Greeks and Trojans have as many religious celebrations as our 21st century Hindus had, and as many secular holidays as an American postal worker. One wonders how they ever managed to kill each other amidst all this feasting and sacrificing to the gods and 10-day funeral celebrations. What fascinates me now, so soon after I vowed to rebel against the gods' will, only to find myself much more of a pawn to their will than ever before, is the question of how quickly and how sharply real events in this war can swerve from the details of Homer's tale. Disparities in the past, the sequence of the gathering of the armies, for instance, or the timing of Paris's aborted battle with Menelaus, have all been minor discrepancies, easily explained by Homer's need to include certain past events in the short span of the poem, set in the 10th year of the war. But what if events really take a different course? What if I were to walk up to, say, Agamemnon this morning and stick this spear, poor doomed Acephalus' spear to be sure, but still a working spear, through the king's heart? The gods can do many things, but they can't return dead mortals to life. Or dead gods either, as oxymoronic as that sounds. "Who are you, Hockenberry, to thwart fate and defy the will of the gods?" queries a craven, professorial little pissant voice that I listened to and followed most of my real life. "I am me, Thomas Hockenberry," comes the reply from the contemporary me, as fragmented as he is, "and right now I'm fed up with these power-addled thugs who call themselves gods. Now, in my role as spy rather than Skolic, I stand close enough to hear the dialogue between Athena, morphed as Laodicus, and that buffoon but fine archer, Pandarus. Speaking as one Trojan warrior to another, Athena Laodicus appeals to the idiot's vanity, tells him that Prince Paris will shower him with gifts if he kills Menelaus, and even compares him to the ultimate archer Apollo, if he has the skill to bring off this shot. Pandarus falls for the ruse, hook, line, and sinker. Athena fired the fool's heart within him, was the way one fine translator described this moment, and has some of his pals hide him from view with their shields while he prepares his longbow and chooses. For centuries, Scholics, Iliad scholars, have argued the issue of whether or not the Greeks and Trojans used poison on their arrows. Most Scholics, myself included, argued the negative. Such behavior simply did not seem to meet these heroes' high standards of honor in battle. We were wrong. They sometimes do use poison, and a lethal, fast-acting poison it is. This explains why so many of the wounds listed in the Iliad were so quickly fatal. Pandarus lets fly. It's a brilliant shot. I track the arrow as it flies hundreds of yards, arcing and then hurtling directly toward Agamemnon's red-headed brother. The shaft will skewer Menelaus as he stands at the forefront of his fighters, watching the heralds jabbering away in no man's land. That is, it will skewer him if no Greek-friendly god intervenes. One does. With my enhanced vision, I see Athena abandon Laodicus' body and QT to Menelaus' side. The goddess is playing a double game here, tricking the Trojans into breaking the truce, and then rushing to make sure that one of her favorites, Menelaus, is not actually killed. Cloaked head to toe, invisible to friend and foe, but visible to this Scholic, she slaps the arrow aside the way a mother flicks a fly from her sleeping son. I think I stole that imagery, but it's been so long since I actually read the Iliad in translation or the original that I can't be sure. Still, despite her protective and deflective slap, the arrow hits home. Menelaus shouts in pain and goes down, the arrow protruding from his midsection just above the groin. Has Athena failed? Confusion ensues. Priam's heralds flee back behind the Trojan lines, and the Achaean negotiators scurry back behind the protection of Greek shields. Agamemnon, who has been using the truce time to inspect his troops lined up row upon row. Perhaps the inspection is timed to show his leadership this first morning after Achilles' mutiny. Arrives to find his brother writhing on the ground, captains and lieutenants huddled around him. I aim a short baton, although the baton looks like the kind of swagger stick a minor Trojan commander might carry. This is not Captain Acepolis' property. It is mine. Standard issue for us Scholics. The baton is actually a taser and a shotgun microphone picking out and amplifying sound from as much as 2 miles away, feeding the pickup to the hear plugs I wear whenever I'm on the plains of Ilium. Agamemnon is giving his dying brother one hell of a eulogy. I see him cradle Menelaus' head and shoulders in his arms and hear him go on about the terrible vengeance he, Agamemnon, will wreak on the Trojans for the murder of noble Menelaus, after which he laments about how the Achaeans will, despite Agamemnon's bloody vengeance, lose heart, give up the war, and take their black ships home after Menelaus dies. After all, what's the use of rescuing Helen if her cuckolded husband is dead? Holding his moaning brother, Agamemnon plays the prophet. But the ploughlands here in Priam will feed your flesh to the worms and rot your bones, O my brother. As you lie dead before the unbreached walls of Troy, your mission failed. Cheery stuff. Just the kind of thing a dying man wants to hear. Wait, 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 grunts Menelaus through gritted teeth. Don't bury me so fast, big brother. The arrowhead's not lodged in a mortal spot, see? It penetrated my bronze war belt and got me in the love handle I've been meaning to lose. Not in the balls or belly. Ah, yes, says Agamemnon, frowning at the wound where the arrow has only lightly penetrated. He almost, not quite, sounds disappointed. The whole eulogy is moot now, and it sounded as if he'd worked on it for a while. But the arrow is poisoned, gasps Menelaus, as if trying to cheer his brother up. Menelaus's red hair is matted with sweat and grass, his golden helmet having rolled away when he fell. Standing, dropping his brother's shoulders and head so quickly that Menelaus would have crashed back to the ground if his captains had not caught him, Agamemnon shouts for Talthybius, his herald, and orders the man to find Machaon, Asclepius' son, Agamemnon's own doctor, and a damned good one, too, since Machaon is supposed to have learned his craft from Chiron, the friendly centaur. Now it looks like any battlefield from any age, a fallen man screaming and cursing and crying as the pain begins to flow through the initial shock of injury. Friends on one knee gathered around, helpless, useless. Then the medic and his assistants arriving, giving orders, pulling the barbed bronze head out of ripping flesh, sucking out poison, packing clean dressings on the wound, even while Menelaus continues to scream like the proverbial stuck pig. Agamemnon leaves his brother to Machaon's ministrations and goes off to rouse his men to combat, although the Achaeans, even without Achilles in their ranks today, seem hungover and angry and surly and in little need of a rousing to get them to fight. Within 20 minutes of Pandarus's ill-conceived arrow shot, the truce is over, and the Greeks attack Trojan lines along a 2-mile stretch of dust and blood. It's time for me to get out of Achepolis' body before the poor son of a bitch catches the spear in the forehead.
I don't remember much of my real life on Earth. I don't remember if I was married, if I had children, where I lived, except for murky images of a book-lined study where I read my books and prepared my lectures. Nor all that much about the university I taught at in Indiana, except images of stone and brick buildings on a hill with a wonderful view to the east. One of the odd things about being a scholic is that fragments of non-scholic essential memories do return after months and years, which may be one of the reasons the gods don't allow us to live that long. I am the oldest exception. But I remember classes, and my students' faces, my lectures, some discussions around an oval table. I remember a fresh-faced young woman asking, "But why did the Trojan War go on so long?" I also remember being tempted to point out to her that she had been raised in an era of fast food and fast wars. McDonald's and the Gulf War, Arby's and the War on Terrorism, but that in ancient days the Greeks and their foes would no more think of hurrying a war than of rushing through a fine meal. Instead of insulting my students' attention spans, I explained to the class how these heroes had welcomed the battle, how one of their words for combat was carme, which came from the same root as caro, rejoice. I read to them a scene in which two warriors facing one another were described as carme gethosinoi, rejoicing in battle. I explained the Greek concept of arster, warrior to warrior, or small group combat in which an individual can show his valor, and how important it was to these ancients, and how the larger battle would often pause so that the soldiers on each side could witness such examples of arster. "So like, you mean like," stammered one fresh-faced female student, her brain running in place, her stammer illustrating that irritating speech and thought defect that spread like a virus among young Americans during the end of the 20th century. "Like the war would have, like, been over a lot sooner if they hadn't kept, like, stopping for this whatchamacallit?" "Precisely," I had said, with a sigh, looking at the old Hamilton clock on the wall in the hope of deliverance. But now, after more than 9 years of watching Aristan in action, I can say in certainty that these one-on-one combats so beloved by both Trojans and Argives are one of the reasons for this prolonged, endless, slow-as-molasses siege. And like even the most sophisticated Middle American traveling too long in France, one of my urges now was to get back to fast food, or in this case, fast war.
A little bombing, a little airborne invasion, bim-bang, thank you, ma'am, home to Penelope.
But not this day. Achepolis is the first Trojan captain to die in the Achaean attack. Perhaps it is because the man is still groggy and disoriented after my borrowing of his body, but as his group of Trojan fighters closes with a Greek group led by Nestor's son Antilochus, a good friend of Achilles,
for Acapulus is slow to raise his long spear. So Antilochus thrusts first. The bronze spear point hits Acapulus' horsehair helmet right at the ridge and drives down through his skull, popping one eye out and driving the man's brains out between his teeth. Acapulus goes down, as Homer likes to say, like a toppled tower. Now begins a dynamic I've seen all too often, but which never ceases to fascinate me. The Greeks and Trojans fight for reasons of honor first, it is true, but booty comes in a close second. These men are professional warriors. Killing is their work and plunder is their pay. A large part of both honor and plunder is the elaborate, beautifully tooled armor, shield, breastplate, greaves, war belt of their fallen foes. Capturing an enemy's gear is the heroic Greek equivalent of a Sioux warrior's counting coup on an opponent, and much more lucrative. At the very least, a captain's protective gear is made of precious bronze, and for the more important officers, it is often hammered out of gold and decorated with jewels. And thus, the fight begins for dead Captain Acapulus' gear. An Achaean commander named Elephenor rushes in, grabs Acapulus' ankles, and begins dragging the gory corpse back through the melee of spears and swords and crashing shields. I've seen Elephenor around the Achaean camp over the years, watched him fight in lesser skirmishes, and I have to say that the man's name suits him. He's huge, with gigantic shoulders, powerful arms, heavy thighs. Not the sharpest knife in Agamemnon's drawer of fighters, but a big, strong, brave, and useful brawler. Thus Elephenor, Chalcodon's son, 38 years old this past June, commander of the Abantes and lord of Euboea, drags Acapulus' corpse behind the screen of thrusting Achaean attackers and begins stripping the body. Then Agenor, a Trojan fighter, son of Antenor, father of Echeclus, both of whom I've seen on the streets of Ilium, slips between the battling Achaeans and catches sight of Elephenor's exposed ribs as the big man bends low beneath the protection of his shield to finish stripping Acapulus' corpse. Agenor leaps forward and stabs his spear into Elephenor's side, splintering ribs and pulping the big man's heart into a shapeless mass. Elephenor vomits blood and collapses. More Trojan fighters surge forward, beating off the Achaean attack, as Agenor rips his spear free and begins to strip Elephenor of his war belt and sheaves and chest plate. Other Trojans drag Acapulus' near-nude body back toward Trojan lines. The fighting begins to swirl around these fallen men. The Achaean called Ajax, Big Ajax, the so-called Telamonian Ajax from Salamis, not to be confused with Little Ajax, who commands the Locrians, hacks his way forward, sheathes his sword, and uses his spear to cut down a very young Trojan named Simoetius, who has come forward to cover Agenor's retreat. Just a week earlier, in the walled safety of Ilium's quiet parks, while morphed as the Trojan Sthenelus, I had drunk wine and swapped ribald stories with Simoetius. The 16-year-old boy, never wed, never even bedded by a woman, had told me about how his father, Anthemion, had named him after the Simois River, which runs right next to their modest home a mile from the walls of the city. Simoetius had not yet turned 6 when the black ships of the Achaeans had first appeared on the horizon, and until a few weeks ago, his father had refused to allow the sensitive boy to join the army outside Ilium's walls. Simoetius admitted to me that he was terrified of dying, not so much of death itself, he said, but of dying before he ever touched a woman's breast or felt what it was like to be in love. Now Big Ajax lets out a cry and thrusts his spear forward, batting aside Simoetius' shield and striking the boy's chest above the right nipple, shattering his shoulder and running the bronze point through and out until it protrudes a foot beyond the boy's mangled back. Simoetius staggers to his knees and stares in astonishment, first at Ajax and then at the spear protruding from his chest. Big Ajax sets his sandaled foot on Simoetius' face and rips the spear free, allowing the boy's body to fall face first into the blood-dampened dust. Big Ajax pounds his chest plate and roars for his men to follow him. A Trojan named Antiphus, standing not more than 25 feet away, hurls his spear at Big Ajax. The spear misses its target but strikes an Achaean named Lucas in the groin, even as Lucas is busy helping Odysseus haul off the corpse of another Trojan captain. The spear passes through Lucas' groin and comes out his anus,
the tip trailing curls of gray and red colon and intestine. Lucas falls on the Trojan captain's corpse, but lives another terrible moment, writhing, grasping the spear and trying to pull it from his groin, but only succeeding in spilling more of his bowels into his own lap. All the time he is tugging at the spear, Lucas is also screaming and tugging at his friend Odysseus' bloody arm. Lucas dies at last, his eyes glazing over, one hand still tight around Antiphus' spear, and the other still clinging to Odysseus' wrist. Odysseus breaks the dead man's grip and whirls around, dark eyes blazing under the rim of his bronze helmet, seeking out a target, any target. Odysseus hurls his spear and rushes after it. More Achaeans follow him into the gap he creates in the Trojan lines. Odysseus' first spear shot kills Demochoon, a bastard son of Ilium's King Priam. I was in the city 9 years ago on the morning Demochoon arrived to help defend Priam's Ilium. It was common knowledge that Priam had put the young man in charge of his famed racing stables in Abydos, a city northeast of Troy on the southern shore of the Hellespont, to keep him out of sight of Priam's wife and legitimate sons. The horses stabled in Abydos were the fastest and finest in the world, and it was said that Demochoon considered it an honor to be named stablemaster at so young an age. Now that young Trojan is in the act of turning his head toward Odysseus' maddened war cry, when the bronze spear point hits him in his left temple and passes through and out his right temple, knocking him off his feet and pinning his shattered skull to the side of an overturned chariot. Demochoon literally never knew what hit him. The Trojans are retreating all along the line now, falling back before the fury of Odysseus and big Ajax, trying to haul their noble dead when possible, abandoning them when not. Hector, Ilium's greatest fighter and most honest man, leaps off his command chariot and wades into the retreat, trying to bring his spear and sword to bear, urging the Trojans to hold fast, but the Achaean attack is too strong at this salient, and even Hector gives ground, all the while urging the men to discipline. The Trojans fight and hack and cast spears as they retreat. Morphed as a minor Trojan spearman, I fall back faster than most, staying out of spear range, not afraid to be a coward. Earlier, I had cloaked myself from mortal view and started to move forward to where I could see Athena behind Achaean lines. Soon joined by Hera, both goddesses invisible to men, but the fighting had erupted too quickly and escalated too fiercely, so I'd left the front lines after Achaepolis fell, trusting to my enhanced vision and shotgun microphone to keep me in touch with events. Suddenly, everything freezes. The air thickens. Spears stop in midair. Blood ceases to flow. Men seconds away from dying get a reprieve they will never know about as all sound ceases, all motion stops. The gods are playing games with time again. Apollo arrives first, his chariot QTing into existence not far from Hector. Then the war god Ares flicks into sight, talks to Athena and Hera an angry minute, and uses his own chariot to fly over the battle lines, landing near Apollo. Aphrodite joins them, glancing my way to where I pretend to be frozen in place like the other mortals, for only an instant before smiling and talking to her two Trojan-loving allies, Ares and Apollo. I watch her out of the corner of my eye, as the goddess stands there pointing and gesturing toward the battlefield like a big-breasted George Patton. The gods are here to fight. Apollo raises his hand, sound crashes in, time begins again like a tsunami of dust and motion, and the killing resumes in earnest. 10. Paris Crater. Ada, Harmon, and Hannah waited the 2 days usually observed as a minimum decent interval after a infirmary visit, and then faxed to Paris Crater to find Demon. It was late and dark and chilly there, and they discovered as soon as they stepped out from under the guarded lion fax node roof, raining. Harmon found them a covered barouche, and a voynix pulled them northwest along a dried riverbed filled with white skulls, past miles of tumble-down buildings. "I've never been to Paris Crater," said Hannah. The young woman, just 2 months shy of her first 20, did not like big cities. PC, 5,000 semi-permanent residents. "It's one reason I faxed us to the guarded lion node rather than a port called Invalid Hotel that's closer to where Demon lives on the rim," said Ada. "Everything about this town is ancient. It's worth taking one's time to look around. Hannah nodded, but doubtfully. The row upon row of stone and steel buildings, most sheathed in shiny everplast, looked empty and dark and cheaply slick in the rain. Servitors and glow globes floated purposefully here and there down the dark streets.
Voynich's stood silent and still on corners, but very few humans were visible.
Then again, as Harmon pointed out, it was after 10 p.m. Even a city as cosmopolitan as Paris Crater had to sleep. "That's interesting," said Hannah, pointing to the structure rising 1,000 feet above the city. Harmon nodded. "It's early Lost Age. Some say it's as old as Paris Crater, maybe even as old as the city that was here before the crater. It's a symbol of the city and the people who built it long ago." "Interesting," Hannah said again. 1,000 feet tall, the rough representation of a naked woman appeared to be made of some clear polymer. The head was sometimes obstructed by low clouds, then briefly visible, and Hannah could see that the face was featureless, except for a gaping grin between red lips. Black, coiled springs 50 feet long spiraled like curls from the spherical head. The legs were spread wide, feet hidden from view behind the dark buildings to the west, but the thighs bunched as thick and wide as Artis Hall. The breasts were huge, globular, absurd, alternately filling and emptying with broiling, photoluminescent red liquid, levels now rising, now filling, now water falling down the insides of the belly and legs, then sometimes rising again all the way to the raised arms and smiling face. The light from the glowing belly and breasts and massive buttocks painted the tops of taller structures around the crater a ruby red. "What's it called?" she asked. "La putain énorme," said Ada. "What does it mean?" "No one knows," said Harmon. He instructed the Voynichs to turn left onto a rickety bridge, and they clip-clopped onto what had once been an island when water flowed in the river of dry skulls, toward the ruins of a building that once must have been quite large. Now a low dome, glowing with a purple light, sat inside the tumbled walls like a strange egg in a nest of scattered stones. "Wait here," Harmon told the Voynichs, and led the two women through the overgrown ruins and into the translucent dome. A slab of white stone about 4 feet high sat in the center of the space. There were gutters at the base of the slab and drains in the stone floor. Behind and above the slab rose a crude statue of a naked man, carved from the same white rock. The man held a bow and a notched arrow. "This is marble," said Hannah, running her hand over the surface of the block. She knew stone. "What is this place?"
"A temple to Apollo," said Harmon.
"I've heard of these new temples," said Ada, "but I've never seen one before. I thought it was rare, a few altars in the forest done as a gag, that sort of thing."
"There are temples like this all over Paris Crater and in the other big cities," said Harmon. "Temples to Athena, Zeus, Ares, all the gods in the Turin tale."
"The drains and gutters," began Hannah. "To drain the blood of the animals sacrificed," said Harmon, "mostly sheep and cattle." Hannah stepped back from the slab and crossed her arms over her chest. "The people wouldn't kill the animals?"
"No," said Harmon. "They have the Voynichs do that, so far."
Ada stood at the open doorway. Rain dripped down the glowing portal, turning it into a purple-tinted waterfall. "What was this place before, the ruins?"
"I'm pretty sure it was a Lost Age temple," said Harmon.
"To Apollo?" Hannah's body was rigid, her arms folded tight against her body. "I don't think so. In the rubble here are bits and pieces of statuary. Not gods, not people, not Voynichs. Not quite. Demons, I think. An old word for them was gargoyle, but I'm not sure what they signify."
"Let's get out of here," said Ada.
Across the river of skulls and west again toward the crater, the broad boulevards ended where the Lost Age buildings became crowned with newer, taller structures. Some very new, probably less than 1,000 years old. A rising latticework of black bucky lace and rain-glistening bamboo tree. Hannah called up a function to find Demon, and the rectangle of light floating above her left palm glowed now amber, now red, then green again, as they took stairways and lifts from street level to mezzanine level, from mezzanine level to the hanging esplanade 15 stories above the old rooftops, then up from Esplanade level to the residential stacks. Hannah paused at the Esplanade rail to look down, mesmerized as most first-time viewers are as they stare into the unblinking red eye, miles and miles below in the bottomless black circle of the crater. Ada had to pull her away with a hand on Hannah's elbow and lead her to the next lift and stairway. Surprisingly, it was a person, not a servitor, who answered the door at Demon's Domi. Ada introduced her group, and the woman, who looked to be in her mid-40s, as all three in 420s did, identified herself as Marina, Demon's mother. She led the way down warmly painted hallways and up interior staircases and through common rooms to the private areas on the crater side of the Domi complex. "The servitor brought the message you were coming, of course," said Marina, pausing outside a beautifully carved mahogany door. "But I haven't told Demon. He is still perturbed by the accident." Harmon said, "But he doesn't remember it?" "Oh, no, of course not," said Marina. She was an attractive woman, and Ada could see the resemblance to her son in her red hair and pleasantly stocky build. "But you know what they say about such things. The cells remember." "But they're not the same cells," thought Ada. She said nothing. "Will it upset Demon to see us?" asked Hannah. To Ada's ear, the young woman sounded more curious than concerned. Marina made a graceful, shrugging motion with her hand as if to say, "We shall see." She knocked on the door and opened it when Demon's muffled voice bid them enter. The room was large and draped with richly colored fabrics, floating silk tapestries and lace curtains around Demon's sleeping area, but the far wall was all glass opening onto a private porch. Lamps in the large room were set low, but the brightly lighted city's edge beyond the balcony curved away on both sides, and more constellations of lanterns, glow globes, and soft electric lights were visible half a mile away across the dark crater. Demon was sitting in a nesting chair by the rain-streaked window, staring out as if pondering the lights. He blinked at the sight of Ada, Harmon, and Hannah, but then waved them over to the circle of soft furniture. Marina excused herself and closed the door behind her as the three took their seats. The glass doors had been opened, and the cool air coming through the screens smelled of rain and wet bamboo. "We wanted to see how you were doing," Ada said, "and I wanted to apologize in person for the accident, for not taking better care of my guest." Demon smiled and shrugged, but his hands were trembling slightly. He set them on his silk-robed knees. "All I remember is something large crashing through the trees, and the smell of carrion, I remember that. And then waking up in the infirmary crash tank. The servitors here told me what happened, of course. It would be amusing if the idea weren't so revolting." Ada nodded, leaned closer, and took his hand. "I do apologize, Demon Ur. The Allosauruses have come onto the estate only very rarely in recent decades, and the Voynichs are always there to protect us." Demon frowned but did not remove his hand from hers. "Evidently, they didn't do a very good job protecting me." "That is strange," said Harmon, crossing his legs and tapping the corrugated paper arms of his chair. "Very strange. I can't remember the last time a Voynich failed to protect a human in such a situation." Demon looked at the older man. "You're used to situations where recombinant animals eat people, Harmon Ur?" "Not at all. I meant situations where human beings are in jeopardy." "I apologize again," said Ada. "The security failure on the part of the Voynichs was inexplicable, but my own carelessness was inexcusable. I'm sorry that your weekend at Artists' Hall was ruined and that your sense of harmony was perturbed." "Perturbed, yes. Perhaps an inadequate word to describe being devoured by a 6-ton carnivore," said Demon. But he smiled slightly and bowed his head even more slightly to acknowledge his acceptance of the apology. Harmon leaned close and clasped his hands, bobbing them up and down for emphasis as he spoke. "We had an unfinished item for discussion, Demon Ur. The spaceship." Now Demon's tone of irony had dripped into sarcasm. Harmon was not deterred. His clasped hands rose and fell with the syllables. "Yes, but not just a spaceship. That's the ultimate goal, of course. But any form of flying machine, Jinker, Sunny, Ultralight, anything to allow us to explore between fax ports. Demon sat back, away from Harmon's intensity, and folded his arms. "Why do you persist with this? Why do you bother me about this?" Ada touched his arm. "Demon." Hannah and I had both heard from different people that at a recent party in Ulaanbaatar, about a month ago, I believe, you told some acquaintances of ours there that you'd once met someone who mentioned seeing a spaceship, and someone who spoke of flying between nodes. Demon managed to look both blank and irritated for a moment, but then he laughed and shook his head. "The witch," he said. "Witch," said Hannah. Demon opened his hands in an echo of his mother's graceful shrugging gesture. "We called her that, I forget her real name. A crazy woman, obviously in her last 20." He shot a glance toward Harmon. "People begin losing touch with reality in their later years." Harmon smiled and ignored the jibe. "You don't remember this woman's name?" Demon gestured again, less gracefully this time. "No." "Where did you meet her?" asked Ada. "The last Burning Man, a year and a half ago. I forget where it was held. Somewhere cold. I just followed friends from Chom when they faxed there. Lost age ceremonies never interested me very much, but there were many fascinating young women at this gathering." "I was there," Hannah said, her eyes bright. "About 10,000 people came." Harmon pulled a much-folded sheet of paper from a tunic pocket and began spreading it on the padded ottoman between them. "Do you remember which node?" Hannah shook her head. "It was one of the half-forgotten nodes, one of the empty ones. The organizers sent the node code around the day before the ceremony began. No one lived there, I think. It was a rocky valley surrounded by snow. I remember that it was light all day, all night for the 5 days of Burning Man, and cold. The servitors had set up a plank field over the whole valley, and heaters here and there in the valley itself, so it wasn't uncomfortable, but no one was allowed beyond the edges of the valley." Harmon looked at his faded and folded sheet of microvellum. The page was covered with squiggly lines, dots, and arcane runes like those found in books. He stabbed a finger down on a dot near the bottom. "Here, in what used to be Antarctica, a node called the Dry Valley." Demon looked at him blankly. "This is a map I've been working on for 50 years, said Harmon. "A two-dimensional representation of the Earth with all the known fax nodes mapped on it, along with their codes. Antarctica was a lost age name for one of these 7 continents. I have 7 Antarctic fax nodes recorded, but only one of them, this Dry Valley that I've heard of but never visited, is free of snow and ice." This obviously did nothing to enlighten Demon. Even Ada and Hannah looked confused. "It doesn't matter," said Harmon, "but if the sun was out all day and all night, this Dry Valley is the probable fax port. During the polar summers, there are days when the sun doesn't set there." "The sun doesn't set in June in Chom," Demon said, obviously bored. "Is that near your Dry Valley?" "No." Harmon pointed to a dot near the top of the map. "I'm pretty sure that Chom is on this large peninsula up here above the Arctic Circle. Near the North Pole, not the South." "North Pole?" said Ada. Demon looked at the two women, "and I thought the witch at Burning Man was crazy." "Do you remember anything else this woman, this witch, said?" asked Harmon, obviously too excited to be insulted. Demon shook his head. He looked tired. "Just babble. We'd been drinking a lot. It was the night of the burning, and we'd been awake for days and nights in that damned daylight, catching a few hours of nap in one of the big orange tents. It was the last night, and there are usually orgies on the last night, and I thought that perhaps she... But she was too old for my tastes." "But she talked about a spaceship?" Harmon was visibly trying to be patient. Demon shrugged again. "Someone there, a young man about Hannah's age, was bemoaning the fact that we didn't have Sonys to fly around in since the final fax, and this witch, who had been very quiet but who was obviously also very drunk, said we did, that there were Jinkers and Sonys if you knew where to look for them. She said she used them all the time." "And the spaceship?" prompted Harmon. "She said she'd seen one is all," said Demon, rubbing his temples as if they hurt. Near a museum. I asked her what a museum was, but she didn't answer. Why did you call this older woman a witch? Asked Hannah. I didn't start it. Everyone called her that. Damon sounded a bit defensive. I think it's because she said she hadn't faxed in, but had walked when it was obvious that she couldn't have. There were no other nodes or structures around the valley, and the Planck field sealed it off. That's true, said Hannah. That last Burning Man may have been in the most remote place I've ever faxed to. I'm sorry I didn't meet this woman there. I only remember her there two nights, said Demon, the first and the last, and she kept to herself except for this one crazy exchange. How did you know that she was old? Ada asked softly. You mean other than her obvious insanity? Yes. Demon sighed. She looked old, as if she had been to the infirmary too many times. He paused then and frowned, obviously thinking about his own recent visit there. She looked older than anyone I've ever seen. I think she actually had those grooves on her face. Wrinkles? Said Hannah. The girl sounded envious. But you don't remember her name, said Harmon. Damon shook his head. Someone by the fire called her by name that night, but I can't quite... I'd been drinking, too, you know, and not sleeping. Harmon glanced at Ada, took a breath, and said, Could it have been Savi? Demon's head came up quickly. Yes, I think it was. Savi, yes, that sounds right. Unusual. He saw Harmon and Ada exchange meaningful glances again and said, What is this significant? Do you two know her? The Wandering Jew, said Ada. Have you heard that legend? Demon smiled tiredly. About the woman who somehow missed the final fax 1,400 years ago, and who's been condemned to wander the earth ever since, of course. But I didn't know the woman in the legend had a name. Savi, said Harmon. Savi's her name. Marina came in with two servitors carrying mugs of mulled wine and a tray of cheese and breads. The uncomfortable silence was broken by small talk while they ate and sipped. We'll fax there tonight, Harmon said to Hannah and Ada. To the dry valley, there might be some clue left. Hannah held her steaming mug in both hands. I don't see how. That Burning Man was, as Demon said, more than 18 months ago. When's the next one? Asked Ada. She never went to such dementia-era ceremonies. It was Harmon who answered. One never knows. The Burning Man cabal sets the time and notifies people only days before the event. Sometimes they're a few months apart, sometimes a dozen years. The one in the Dry Valley was the last one. If you've been to any of the previous three, you're invited. I missed it because I was hiking in the Mediterranean basin. I want to go with you to find this woman, said Demon. The others, including his mother, looked at him with surprise. Do you feel up to it? Asked Ada. He ignored the question and said, You'll need me to identify the woman if you find her this... Savi. All right, said Harmon. We appreciate your help. But we'll fax out in the morning, said Demon. Not tonight. I'm tired. Of course, said Ada. She looked at Hannah and Harmon. Shall we fax back to Ardis? Nonsense, said Marina. You'll be our guests tonight. We have comfortable guest dummies on the upper level. She caught Ada's subtle glance in Demon's direction. My son has been very tired since the accident. He may sleep 10 hours or more. If you stay as our guest, you'll be ready to leave together after he wakes, after breakfast. 7-hour difference between Paris Crater and Ardis. It was not yet dinner time back at Ardis Hall, but like all fax travelers, they were used to adapting to local times. We'll show you to your rooms, said Marina, leading the way across the room with her twin servitors floating beside her. The rooms were actually small dummies, elaborate suites of their own, one flight up from Marina and Demon's place and reached by a broad spiral staircase. Anna expressed approval of her space, but then went out to explore Paris Crater on her own. Harmon said his goodnights and disappeared into his dummy. Ada locked the door behind her, inspected the interesting tapestries, enjoyed the view of the crater from the balcony. The rain had stopped and the moon and rings were visible between scattering clouds, and then went in and ordered a light dinner from the servitors. Afterward, she drew a bath and luxuriated in the hot, perfumed water for half an hour or more, feeling the ache of tension leave her muscles. She had met Harmon only 12 days earlier, but it seemed much longer ago. A man and his interests fascinated her. Ada had gone to a summer solstice party at a friend's estate near the ruins of Singapore. Not because she liked parties. She tended to avoid both faxing and parties when she could help it, traveling almost solely to old friends' homes for small gatherings. But because her younger friend Hannah was going to be there and had urged her to attend. The solstice party had been fun in its way, and many of the people interesting, since her friend there had just celebrated her 420. Ada had always enjoyed the company of people older than herself. But then she had met Harmon, coming across him as he was poking through the estate's library. The man was quiet, reticent even, but Ada had drawn him out using some of the tactics her smarter friends had used on her to get her to talk more. Ada did not know what to think about Harmon's trick of learning how to read without a function. He had not confessed the ability until another meeting at another friend's house just 6 days before the gathering at Artis Hall. But the more Ada thought about it, the more amazed she was. Ada had always considered herself to be well-educated. She knew all the usual folk songs and legends. She had memorized the 11 families and all their members. She knew many of the fax notes by heart. But Harmon's breadth of both knowledge and curiosity left her breathless. The map he had laid out in front of Demon, so underappreciated even by curious, adventurous Hannah, continued to astound Ada. She had never even run across the concept of map before Harmon had shown her the diagrams less than a week earlier. It was Harmon who had explained to her that the world was a sphere. How many of Ada's friends knew that? How many of them had ever wondered about the shape of the world on which they lived? Of what use was that arcane bit of knowledge? The world was your home, and the fax network you used to see your friends in their homes. Whoever thought about the shape of the physical structure that lay beneath and beside that fax net? And why would they? Ada knew even from that first weekend around Harmon that the man's interest in the long-departed post-humans bordered on obsession. No, amended Ada, lying in the warm bath water and moving bubbles up her breasts to her throat with her long, pale fingers. It is an obsession with Harmon. He can't stop thinking about the post-humans. Where they are, why they left, to what purpose. Ada did not know the answer, of course, but she had come to share in Harmon's passionate curiosity, approaching it as a game, an adventure. And he kept asking questions that would have made any of Ada's other friends simply laugh. Why are there just a million of us humans? Why was that number chosen by the posts? Why never one more, one less? And why 100 years assigned to each of us? Why do they save us even from our own follies so we can live 100 years? The questions were so simple and so profound that they were embarrassing. It was like hearing an adult ask why we have belly buttons. But Ada had joined in the quest for a flying machine, perhaps a spaceship to fly up to the rings and talk to the post-humans in person. Now for this final fax-era legend of the Wandering Jew, and every day that passed brought more excitement. Like Demon being eaten by an Allosaurus. Ada blushed, seeing her pale skin redden down to the line of water and bubbles. That had been terribly embarrassing. None of the other guests could ever remember anything similar happening. Why hadn't the Voynichs offered better protection? What exactly are the Voynichs? Harmon had asked her 12 days earlier in the treehouse complex near Singapore. Where do they come from? Did the Lost Age humans build them? Are they a produce of the Rubicon dementia? Did the posts create them? Or are they alien to this world and time and here for their own purposes? Ada remembered her uneasy laughter that evening as they sat on the vined terrace, champagne in hand, when he had asked such an absurd question in such serious tones. But she had not been able to answer it then, nor had her friends in the intervening days, although their laughter was more nervous even than her own had been. And now Ada, after a lifetime of seeing Voynichs every day, looked at them with a curiosity bordering on alarm. Hannah had begun to react the same way. What are you? She had wondered just that evening as they had stepped out of their barouche in Paris Crater and left the Voynichs standing there apparently eyeless its rusted carapace and leathery hood wet from the rain, its killing blades retracted, but manipulator pads extended and curled, still holding the stays of their carriage. Ada stepped out of the water, dried herself, slipped into a thin robe, and told the servitors to leave her. They exited via one of their osmotic wall membranes. Ada went out onto the balcony. Harmon's room and balcony adjoined hers on the right, but privacy on the porches was assured by a tightly latticed bamboo fiber screen that extended 3 feet out beyond the porch railing. Ada walked to the partition, stood at her rail a moment, looking down at the red-eyed crater below, lifted her eyes to the clearing sky with its stars and moving rings, and then she flung her leg over the railing, feeling the smooth, wet bamboo against the flesh of her inner thigh an instant before she stepped out barefoot, feeling her way along the thin rim of the partition. For a second, she was connected to the porch only by the pressure of her toes and fingertips, feeling blindly around the partition on the other side to find the matching narrow ledge, feeling gravity pull her back into emptiness. What would it feel like to fall so far toward burning magma, to know that I would be dead after a few terrible and totally free minutes of falling? She knew she would never know. If she let go now, if her bare toes and fingers slipped now, she would never remember the next seconds and minutes after she awoke in the infirmary tanks. The post-humans did not grant humans memories of their own death. Ada pressed her breasts against the edge of the partition, fought to find balance, and swung her left leg around, her bare foot finding the narrow bamboo seam running back to Harmon's porch. She did not dare look up to see if Harmon was out on his balcony or at the glass door. All her attention was focused, keeping her toes from slipping, her fingers from sliding off the wet and slippery bamboo tree. She reached the porch and stepped onto the edge of it, clinging to the railing so tightly that her arms were shaking. Feeling her strength ebbing in the post-adrenaline surge of weakness, she quickly swung her left leg up and over, feeling the robe fall open, scratching the underside of her leg on a seam in the railing. Harmon was sitting cross-legged on a white-cushioned chaise lounge, watching her. His balcony was lighted by a single, glass-shielded candle. "You might have helped," she whispered, not knowing why she said it or why she was whispering. She saw that Harmon was also wearing nothing but a thin silk guest robe, only loosely sashed. He smiled and shook his head. "You were doing fine, but why not just come around and knock?" Ada took a deep breath and, as in answer, loosened the belt of her robe and let it open. The air, moving in from above the crater, was cool, but with currents of warmer air embedded in the breeze as it caressed her lower belly. Harmon rose, crossed to her, looked her in the eyes, and closed her robe, tying it without pressing his fingers against her. "I am honored," he said, also whispering now. "But not yet, Ada, not yet." He took her hand and led her to the chaise longue. When both of them were lying back on it side by side, Ada blinking in surprise and blushing in something like humiliation, whether at the rejection or at her own brazenness, she was not sure. Harmon reached behind the chair and came out with 2 cream-colored Turin scarves. He folded each so that the embroidered microcircuitry was properly positioned. "I don't," began Ada. "I know. But just this once. I think that something important's about to happen. Let us share this." She lay back on the soft cushion and let Harmon adjust the Turin across her eyes. She felt him lie back next to her, his right hand lying loosely across her left hand. The images and sounds and sensations flowed in. 11. The Plains of Ilium. The gods have come down to play. More precisely, they have come down to kill. The battle has been raging for some time now, with the god Apollo lashing on the Trojans, with Athena spurring on the Argives, and other gods lounging in the shade of a tree on the nearest hill, sometimes laughing, Iris and their other servants pouring them wine. I've watched the Thracian chief Pirous, a bold Trojan ally, kill gray-eyed Diores with a rock. Diores, co-commander of the Appian contingent of the Greeks, went down with only a broken ankle after battle-maddened Pyrrhus threw the rock. But most of Diary's comrades fell back. Pyrrhus hacked his way through the few who had stayed to guard their fallen captain, and, helpless now, his ankle smashed, poor Diaries had to lie there while Pyrrhus rushed in, speared the Thracian in the belly with his long casting spear, and pulled the man's bowels out, hooking them on the barbed spear point and twisting more out while Diaries screamed. This was the flavor of the last half hour's battle, and it was a relief when Pallas Athena raised her hand, received nodded permission from other watching gods, and stopped time and motion in their tracks. Now, with my enhanced vision, enhanced by the contact lenses from the gods, I can see Athena across the milling no-man's land of lances, preparing Tydeus' son Diomedes as a killing machine. I mean this almost literally. Like the gods themselves, and like me, Diomedes the man will now be part machine. His eyes and skin and very blood enhanced by nanotechnologies from some future age far beyond my short lifespan. In frozen time, Athena sets contact lenses similar to mine in the Achaean's eyes, allowing him to see both the gods and, somehow, to slow time a bit when he concentrates in the thick of the action, thus, to the unenhanced onlooker's view, increasing his reaction time threefold. Homer had written that Athena had set the man ablaze, and now I understand the metaphor. Using the nanotechnology embedded in her palm and forearm, Athena is busy turning the negligible, latent electromagnetic field around Diomedes' body into a serious force field. In the infrared, Diomedes' body and arms and shield and helmet suddenly blazed with tireless fire like the star that flames at harvest. I realize now, watching Diomedes glow in the thick amber of God-frozen time, that Homer must have been referring to Sirius, the dog star, rising as the brightest star in the Greek and Trojan sky in late summer. It is in the eastern sky this night. As I watch, she also injects billions of nanotech molecular machines into Diomedes' thigh. As always with such a nano-invasion, the human body deals with it as an infection, and Diomedes' temperature goes up at least 5 degrees. I can watch the invading army of molecular machines moving up his thigh to his heart, from his heart to his lungs and arms and legs again, the heat making his body glow even more brightly in my infrared vision. All around me, battlefield death is held in abeyance these stretched minutes. 10 yards to my left, I see a chariot frozen in a bubble of dust and human sweat and equine saliva. The Trojan charioteer, a short, even-tempered man named Phegeus, son of Troy's foremost priest to the god Hephaestus, and brother to stout Idaeus. In my morphed disguises, I had broken bread and drunk wine with Idaeus 12 times in the past few years. Is petrified in the act of leaning over the front of his chariot, the chariot rim in his left hand, a long throwing spear in his right. Idaeus stands next to his brother, frozen in the act of whipping on the motion-halted horses while clutching the rigid reins in his other hand. The chariot has been halted in the act of bearing down on Diomedes, all the human players here unaware that the goddess Athena has stopped everything while she plays dolls with her chosen companion, dressing Diomedes in force fields and through-view contact lenses and nano-augmenters like some preteen girl playing with her Barbie. I remember a small girl playing with Barbie dolls, perhaps a sister from my own childhood. I don't believe I had a daughter of my own. I'm not sure, of course, because the memories returning over the past months are like shards of glass with clouded reflections in them. I am close enough to the chariot to see the exaltation of combat chiseled into Phegeus' tanned face, and the fear frozen into his unblinking brown eyes. If Homer reported all this correctly, Phegeus will be dead in less than a minute. I see other gods flocking to the battle site now like carrion crows to slaughter. There is Ares, god of war, flicking into solidity on my side of the battle lines, stepping close to the time-halted chariot holding Idaeus and his doomed brother. Ares' palms open his own force field behind the frozen chariot, carrying the two brothers toward death. Why does Ares care what happens with these two? True, Ares is no lover of the Greeks. He has obviously learned to hate them in this war and kills them through his instruments or his own agency when he can.
But why this obvious concern about Phegeus or his brother Idaeus?
Is it just a counter-move to Athena's strategy of enabling Diomedes? This chess game with real human beings falling and screaming and dying has grown old to me, an obscenity. But the strategy still intrigues me. Then I remember that the god of war is half-god brother to Hephaestus, the god of fire, also born to Zeus's wife Hera. Phegeus and Idaeus' father, Dares, has performed long and faithful service to the fire god within Troy's walls. This idiot war is more complicated and senseless than the Vietnam War I half remember from my youth. Suddenly, Aphrodite, my new spymaster and boss, QTs into existence 30 yards to my left. She's also here to help the Trojans and to enjoy the slaughter, but in the last slowed seconds before real time resumes, I remember that if the actual fighting goes the way of the old poem, Aphrodite herself will be injured by Diomedes in the coming hour. Why would she come down to the fray, knowing that a mortal will wound her? The answer is the same that I've been reminded of so forcibly over the past 9 years, but now the fact of it hits me with the force and flash of a nuclear explosion. The gods don't know what will happen next. None but Zeus, it seems, is allowed to peer ahead at fate's checklist. All of us Skoliks are aware of this. We are not allowed, by Zeus's prohibition, to discuss future events with the gods, and they are forbidden to ask us about the future books of the Iliad. Our task is only to confirm after the fact that Homer's Iliad has been truthful to the events of the day we are tasked to observe and record. Many's the time that Knightenhelzer and I, while watching the little green man haul their face stones toward the shore as the sun sets behind the sea to the west, have commented on this paradox of the gods' own blindness to coming events. I know that Aphrodite will be injured this day, but the goddess herself does not. How can I use this information? If I were to tell Aphrodite, Zeus would know. I don't know how he would know, but I know he would, and I would be atomized and Aphrodite punished in some lesser way. How can I use the information that Aphrodite, the goddess giving me these gifts to spy with, will be, maybe, injured by Diomedes this day? I don't have time to find the answer. Athena finishes her fussing with Diomedes and releases her grip on space and time. Real light and terrible noise and violent motion resumes. Diomedes steps forth, body and face and shield blazing, the light evidently apparent even to the other mortals, visible to his fellow Achaeans and the opposing Trojans. Idaeus completes the motion of lashing his horses forward. The chariot roars and rumbles toward the Greek line directly at the startled Diomedes. Phegeus hurls his spear at Diomedes. The spear misses by an inch, the spear point passing over the son of Tydeus' left shoulder. Diomedes, skin flushed, forehead blazing with fever sweat and battle heat, hurls his own spear. It flies true, catching Phegeus dead center in the chest, between the nipples, I think Homer had sung it in Greek. And Phegeus is flung backward off the chariot, striking the ground and cartwheeling several times, the spear breaking off and splintering as the corpse tumbles to a stop in the dust of the chariot he had been riding 5 seconds before. Death, when it comes fast on the plains of Ilium. Idaeus leaps off the chariot, rolls and struggles to his feet, sword in hand, prepared to protect his brother's body. Diomedes snatches up another spear and rushes forward again, obviously ready to spit Idaeus the way he has just slaughtered the young man's brother. The Trojan turns to flee, leaving his brother's body behind in the dust in his panic. But Diomedes throws strong and true, casting the long spear at the center of the running man's back. Ares, the god of war, flies forward, literally flies forward, using the same type of levitation harness the gods have issued me, and pauses, time again, protecting Idaeus from a flying spear, now frozen not 10 feet from the running man's back. Then Ares extends his force field around Ideas, resuming time long enough for the energy field to deflect Diomedes' spear. Then Ares quantum teleports the terrified man off the battlefield completely, sending him somewhere safe. To the shocked and terrified Trojans, it is as if a blink of black night has snatched their comrade away. So that Ares' brother Hephaestus, the fire god, will not have lost both his future priests, I think, but then lurch backward to safety as the battle resumes and more Greeks follow Diomedes into the breach, created by the killing of Phegeus. The empty chariot bounces across the rocky plain and is captured by cheering Achaeans. Ares is back now, QTing into semi-solidity, a tall godshape as he tries to rally the Trojans, shouting in a god voice for them to regroup and fend off Diomedes. But the Trojans are split, some running in terror at the approach of blazing Diomedes, some turning in obedience to the war god's booming voice. Suddenly Athena levitates across the heads of Greeks and Trojans, seizes Ares' wrist, and whispers urgently to the furious god. The two QT away. I look to my left again, and the goddess Aphrodite, invisible to the Greeks and Trojans, struggling and cursing and dying around her, motions with her hand for me to follow them. I pull down Death's helmet and become invisible to all the gods except Aphrodite. Then I trigger the medallion around my neck and QT after Athena and Ares, following their passage through space-time as easily as I would follow footprints in wet sand. It's easy being a god, if you have the right equipment. They have not teleported far, only about 10 miles, to a shaded place along the banks of the Scamander. The gods call it the Xanthus, the broad river that runs across the plains of Ilium. When I QT into solidity about 15 paces from them, Ares' head snaps around and he stares right at me. For an instant, I know that the Hades helmet has failed. They see me, and I am dead. "What is it?" asks Athena. I thought I felt something, a stir, a quantum stir. The goddess turns her gray eyes in my direction. There's nothing there I can see in all the phase shift spectra. "I can as well," snaps Ares and turns his gaze away from me. I let out a shaky breath as silently as I can. The Hades helmet still cloaks me. The god of war begins pacing up and down the river's edge. "Zeus is everywhere these days." Athena walks beside him. "Yes, father is angry at us all." "Then why do you provoke him?" The goddess stops. "Provoke him how? By defending my Achaeans from slaughter?" "By preparing Diomedes to do slaughter," says Ares. I notice for the first time the reddish tint to the tall, perfectly muscled god's curly hair. "This is a dangerous thing you do, Pallas Athena." The goddess laughs softly. "We've been intervening in this battle for 9 years. It's the game, for God's sake. It's what we do. I know that you plan to intervene on your beloved Ilium's behalf this very day, slaughtering my Argives like sheep. Is this not dangerous, this active participation by the god of war? Not as dangerous as arming one side or the other with nanotech. Not as dangerous as retrofitting them with phase shift fields. What are you thinking, Athena? You're trying to turn these mortals into us, into gods." Athena laughs again, but puts on a serious expression when she notices that her laughter only makes Ares more angry. "Brother, my augmentation of Diomedes is short-lived, you know that. I want only for him to survive this encounter. Aphrodite, your darling sister, has already urged on the Trojan archer Pandarus to wound one of my favorites, Menelaus. And even as we speak, she's whispering in the archer's ear, 'Kill Diomedes.'" Ares shrugs. "I know that Aphrodite is his ally and his instigator, like a pouting little boy, an 8-foot-tall pouting little boy with a pulsing energy field. He finds a smooth stone and skips it across the water. What does it matter if Diomedes dies today or next year? He's mortal, he'll die." Now Athena laughs without embarrassment. "Of course he will die, my dear brother. And of course a single mortal's life or death is of no consequence to us, to me. But we must play the game. I'll not let that bitch-whore Aphrodite change the will of the fates." "Who among us knows the will of the fates?" snaps Ares, still pouting, his arms folded across his powerful chest. "Father does. Zeus says he does, says the god of war with a sneer. Are you doubting our lord and master? Athena's tone is almost, not quite, light and teasing. Ares looks around quickly, and for a second I fear I've given myself away by making a noise where I stand on a flat boulder, afraid to leave footprints in the sand. But the war god's gaze moves on. I show no disrespect to our father, Ares says at last, his voice reminding me of Richard Nixon's when he was speaking into the hidden Oval Office microphone he knew was there, putting his lies on the record. My allegiance and loyalty and love all go to Zeus, Pallas Athena. Which our father must certainly note and reciprocate, responds Athena, no longer hiding the sarcasm in her voice. Suddenly Ares' head snaps up. God damn you, he shouts. You just brought me here to get me away from the battlefield while your cursed Achaeans kill more of my Trojans. Of course. Athena launches the two syllables as a taunt, and for a second I think I'm going to witness something I've not seen in my 9 years here. A direct battle between two gods. Instead, Ares kicks sand in a final show of petulance and QTs away. Athena laughs, kneels by the scamander, and splashes cold water on her face. Fool, she whispers, to herself, I presume, but I take it as a statement directed at me, protected here only by the Hades helmet's distortion field. Fool, seems to me, an accurate judgment of my folly. Athena QTs back to the battlefield. After a minute devoted to trembling at my own foolishness, I phase shift and follow. The Greeks and Trojans are still killing each other. Big news. I seek out the only other Skolic visible on the field. To the unaided eye, Knightenhalser is just another slovenly Trojan foot soldier hanging back from the worst of the fighting. But I can see the telltale green glow the gods have marked us Skoliks with even when we're morphed. So I take off the Hades helmet, morph into the form of Phalces, a Trojan who will be killed by Antilochus by and by, and I walk over to join Knightenhalser where he stands on a low ridge looking down on the carnage. Good morning, Skolik Hockenberry, he says when I approach. We're speaking in English. No other Trojan is near enough to hear us over the clash of bronze and the rumble of chariots, and both of these motley coalitions are used to odd tribal languages and dialects. Good morning, Skolik Knightenhalser. Where have you been the last half hour or so? Taking a break, I say. It happens. Sometimes the carnage gets to be too much even for us Skoliks, and we QT away to Troy for a quiet hour or so, or for a large flagon of wine. Did I miss much? Knightenhalser shrugs. Diomedes came charging in about 20 minutes ago and was struck by an arrow right on schedule. Pandarus arrow, I say, nodding. Pandarus is the same Trojan archer who wounded Menelaus earlier. I saw Aphrodite inciting Pandarus, says Knightenhalser. The big man has his hands in the pockets of his rough cape. Trojan capes had no pockets, of course, so Knightenhalser had sewn these in. End of side 3.